you, Jessica. Thank you, Chris. Beautiful song. Thanks so much. Yeah, feeling the peace. Sometimes, right? Not all the time. I was just talking with some folks back in the social hall about how this thing that we're experiencing, this pandemic, has gone on so much longer than we might have anticipated, and we don't, you know, really know when the end in sight is. So I hope that's a comfort to you. you know, I know that we as a spiritual center and you know, many of us made personal decisions that were based on, oh, this will be done in, you know, a couple of months and then we're good to go. Not so much. And I've noticed that with some of this this uncertainty that I've been speaking about pretty much at great length for the last couple of weeks, because it does seem to be a theme that's arising for a lot of people. But I've noticed another theme arising with this uncertainty, kind of a byproduct of it, and that is grumpiness. Has anybody besides me, maybe it's just me, but has anybody noticed that people seem kind of grumpy right now? I'm looking over here where there's a few people sitting. Okay, Chris, all right. Okay, in the back too, all right. So yeah, there's. I think anxiety sometimes leads to fear and grumpiness. It manifests as grumpiness. You know, when we lived in the South, we used to say, well, she done got hit by the ugly stick. Because in the South, ugly means grumpy or mean-spirited. Also, ill means mean-spirited, like ill-tempered. So she's really ill today. Doesn't mean she's sick, means she's grumpy. So I've been using my Southern vocabulary quite a bit lately because there's grumpy people all over. Okay, enough about that. So one thing that I've noticed, and I can't say that I've been particularly grumpy about it, but, you know, I've been speaking a lot to the issues of the pandemic and some of the stuff that's happening in the world, and every Sunday I feel like, you know, I did pretty well, but I didn't quite get where I wanted to go with it. Because really where I want to go with it is a mystical place, a place that is beyond the ideas of right doing and wrong doing, and a place that abides not only when we're done with this business, but is in this business that we're in right now and always. So I was thinking about that, thinking about you know, how I feel like I haven't quite done the job I want to do up here on Sundays for the last couple of weeks. And then I was listening to my friend Alexa, who entertains me at home quite a bit, and she kept singing this song, this Sanatam Kaur chant. And she played it like 6 times without me asking for it. And I thought, well, that's probably a sign. You know, that's probably a sign. I should probably look up the translation of that chant. And by the way, I love that chant because when it plays, I go into a zone. I miss meetings. I miss appointments because I'm listening to the chant and waiting for it to turn to a minor key. So, you know, there's this draw that I have towards this chant. So I looked up the translation, and that was what Hugh read for the sacred reading because I'm like, oh, that's what I want to convey. Yes, that is what I want to convey. Where we use our whole self, our whole soul as an alms bowl for the divine, where we allow the divine to pour into us, and that's all that we need. And when we recognize that the voice of reality is shrill, but guess what? God is there too. The voice of the pandemic is shrill, but guess what? God is there too. God is there in everything. And the idea that we wrap ourselves in song, and that we the song of the universe means one song, and we wrap ourselves in that, and we meditate into infinity until we meditate even when we're not meditating. I don't even know what that means, but I think it's super cool, and I love it. I love it. This is the kind of reality that we're going for, and if you are willing to take this leap with me, it would make me so very happy, but don't do it for me. Do it for yourselves. Do it for the well-being of the world, because in all of the stuff, in all of the chatter that we hear in the world, this aspect is missing, this spiritual aspect of that which is beyond the ideas of wrongdoing and rightdoing, Rumi's field, and so that's what we're here to do. That's what we're here to accomplish. Funny though, what I noticed in that reading that Hugh did, there was one line that went kind of like, that's interesting. She suggested that we clothe ourselves in self-control. Now she's talking about an ecstatic universe, an ecstatic world. I keep saying she because Sanatam Kaur sings it, but it was actually given by a male guru. But she's talking about an ecstatic world, but yet we clothe ourselves in self-control. And it reminds me of what I think about freedom, that freedom is achieved through self-discipline, which is a paradox. And perhaps ecstasy is achieved through a certain amount of self-control. And so today, I am hoping that I will find the words to help us explore a particular subset of self-control, something that we may not want to do, that I may not want to do, and that is to practice the self-control of blameless accountability. Blameless accountability. What does that even mean? Blameless accountability. I mean, isn't that, can you have accountability without blame? Isn't blameless accountability an oxymoron? You know? I looked at, well, and also, if you don't blame something or somebody for something that went wrong, then how do you identify the problem, the root cause of the problem? You know, in my husband's work, he's a business consultant, and they often talk about root cause analysis. And I'm like, me. Sorry. but yeah, root cause. It's helpful to know the root cause of something. So isn't blame a part of that? Well, when I say blame, I mean judgment with condemnation. There is discernment with forgiveness. And that's how I'm separating out these two categories. But it seems that we often sneak into the blaming, the judgment with condemnation part. Condensation, like sweating, right? It seems that we often slip into the blame, the judgment with condemnation when we talk about blame, and call it identifying the root cause when it's really something else. It's really stirring the pot in a way that we don't want it to stir. I looked at what some of the mystics said about blame. I started with Ernest Holmes because he is the founder of this religion that we teach here, this philosophy that we teach here. I looked in the Concordance for the Science of Mind textbook, and oddly, the Concordance of the Science of Mind textbook does not have the word blame in it. It goes right from bladder to blasphemy. Now you figure that out. I don't know about that. But I did look up what the bladder part, and guess what causes bladder problems according to Ernest Holmes? Blame. Well, something like it, you know, blame or judgment or that type of thing. Irritability with others. Oh my God. I gotta leave. No, I'm kidding. So he doesn't talk a lot about blame, but he does certainly talk about accountability. Accountability, he uses the word responsibility more, because the whole crux of the Science of Mind teaching is that we are responsible for our reactions to things. We hold ourselves accountable to the quality of the thoughts that we're thinking and how we choose to relate to reality. And we're often relating from a place of ego to reality. But if we are accountable, if we are responsible, the quality of our thoughts always affects the quality of our lives, of our experience. And if we are accountable and calling forth the thoughts that support that reality that was talked about in the sacred reading, that reality where we allow ourselves to be the alms bowl for God, to allow God to pour itself through us where we need nothing more than God, then the quality of our life is magnificent, and it has nothing to do with what is going on outside of us. It has nothing to do with the state of the world. So we use the self-control to move ourselves into a place where the quality of our thoughts is excellent. And one of those excellent thoughts is blameless accountability. I looked up a little bit about this in terms of other, you know, I looked on the internet, on Google, to see if this was even a thing, if anybody was using this term, blameless accountability. And what I found was that a lot of businesses right now are creating what they call a blameless culture. And what they find is that if they are reluctant to blame people for mistakes, then people are much more open about the mistakes that they make, and they can be corrected. And individually, don't you feel that that might be true for you or for me or for any of us, that when we think that we're going to get blamed for something, we tend to want to hide it, right? I know I've done that. I don't think I'll give you any examples, but I know that I've done that, because that wouldn't be hiding it anymore, would it? But there is this thing of when we're afraid of the consequence, we don't become open. And if we're doing blameless and shameless accountability, as our lovely harpist said, you know, then there is a much more forgiving, we're stepping into forgiveness where, and it's said in the business model, that we can move beyond the person and start examining the process. And start seeing what is wrong from a root cause analysis position where it has very little to do with the person and much more to do with the process. And the same thing is true for us. Because, you know, in this teaching, we believe that most of the work is done on the inside. We are here to work on ourselves, and we thank anybody and everything that gives us the opportunity. I'm quoting George Gurdjieff, by the way, by saying that, but Ernest Holmes pretty much says the same thing in his textbook, that we are here to work on ourselves, and we thank anyone or anything that gives us the opportunity. You know, and the reason this works, we start with self-accountability, blameless self-accountability. And the reason that this works is because of another Ernest Holmes phrase that I love, and that is, your judgment judges you. My judgment judges me. We could as well say, our blame blames you. No, my blame blames me. Your blame blames you. And, you know, some people wonder what that means, but if you think about it, like I was trying to think of an example of this in my own life, and, you know, I've been doing this this job now for, since the days of covered wagons, it seems like. It's been a long time. I've been here for about 17 years, and then I was at another church for about two and a half, 3 years. And one of the things that I noticed that ministers really don't like, and I'm the same way, is I do not like being called a hypocrite. And so I looked at that as I was thinking about this talk. Okay, what is it exactly? What is the dynamic here? And the thing is that I noticed that one of my greatest judgments about people is when I think that others are a hypocrite, and I judge them for being a hypocrite. So my judgment of others is saying it's really, really bad to be a hypocrite. So when somebody calls me a hypocrite, I say, it's really, really bad to be a hypocrite. You're a bad person, Bonnie. You should be ashamed of that. So that's how it works. That's how your judgment judges you. That's how our blame blames us. You know, and if we're moving into a place of blame, blameless accountability, it's so much easier to say, you know what, I got to tell you, sometimes I am a hypocrite sometimes. I mean, isn't everybody, right? Stand up. If you, at home or here, if you have never, ever been a hypocrite, so that we may worship your feet. I don't see anybody standing. Okay. And if you're standing at home, you need to type into Annette, and she'll tell me about it later, so I can come and, I don't know, learn from you or something. Because I know that there are times when I am just the biggest hypocrite. On the way to church, doing the exact opposite of what I'm going to be speaking about, or on the way home from church, I've just given a message about something that felt so passionate and so real, and then something happens on the way home, and I decide to forget all about it. I lied to Weight Watchers. I lied about how many points I had one day. Well, actually, that's a lie, too. It was more than one day, you know, so... It's like all the time. That's why I can't do Weight Watchers. It brings out the liar in me. And I don't know why. I'm having a meltdown. I don't know why. It's like Weight Watchers isn't going to care. God sees how many points I've eaten. Okay. So you see what it's like. You see how we are. I hope I'm not the only one. Raise your hand if you've ever lied to Weight Watchers. Oh, board president. Okay, good to know. Okay, and you all at home can raise your hands too, because God is watching you, and God knows if you've lied to Weight Watchers or something similar. let me move on to what I had planned to say. So it starts with self-accountability, because the real work really happens inside. You know, all going through India and working with Service Base, we lead by inner transformation. Gandhi, we lead by inner transformation. We act like the change that we wish to see in the world. We be the change that we wish to see in the world. And so self-accountability is a powerful, powerful thing, because it helps us untangle our judgments of ourselves and our others. And we can, if we're going to practice self-accountability, we better darn well do it in a blameless manner, or else, again, we will suppress stuff. And what we suppress tends to regress, and what we do not transform, we tend to transmit. So it's a beautiful, beautiful thing to practice self-accountability, to say to ourselves, you know what, I am a hypocrite sometimes. Or to say, you know what, I do sometimes lie to Weight Watchers. Or sometimes I'm less kind than I want to be. Or sometimes I'm impatient with people. Or sometimes people are getting on my nerves and I say things about them in my head that I shouldn't say. Self-accountability is a beautiful thing. I kind of got started on this role about self-accountability because of this process I was involved in with my friends at Service Base. I was a volunteer for a month-long study, and we had a lot of reading to do every day, and then there were a bunch of people on the call, and we interacted with them as well. And one of the women in the groups, her name was Sarah, and she introduced me to a website called, I have to look it up because I can't remember. It's a really good website, and I did not write down the name. However, the author's name, it's a blog, and the author is Mia Mingus. She's an activist, and one of the reasons that I was attracted to her writing was that she wrote, "The head shows proof. The head requires proof, but the heart just leaves evidence." Again, I'm not sure what that means, but to me it means like the head is always looking around, should I do this, should I be accountable, should I move into blame, should I find the root cause, and the heart is just like, no, just do it, just leave evidence of your goodness, just be that alms bowl for God. The head needs proof, the heart leaves evidence. So Mia Mingus, she said this so beautifully. She wrote a blog piece called Dreaming Accountability, where she dreams of a world where everybody is accountable all the time, and that it is a joy to be accountable. I'm going to read you what she wrote. It's a little bit long, but I really liked it. And she writes, "What if accountability wasn't scary? Take a breath and let that sink in for a second. What if accountability wasn't scary? It'll never be easy or comfortable, but what if it wasn't scary? What if our own accountability wasn't something that we ran from, but something that we ran towards and that we desired and appreciated and held as sacred? What if we cherished opportunities to take accountability as precious opportunities to practice liberation, to practice love? We can start with our self-accountability and the ways that we don't show up for ourselves. We can acknowledge how most of us are in a somewhat abusive relationship with ourselves. What if we rushed towards our accountability and understood it as a gift that we can give to ourselves and those hurting from our harm? What if we understood our accountability not as some small insignificant act, but as an intentional drop in an ever-growing river of healing, care, and repair that has the potential to nourish comfort and build back trust on a large scale, carving new paths of hope and faith through mountains of fear and unacknowledged pain for generations? What if we took more time to actually dream accountability? What it could be, and the kind of magic it could grow. What we need in order to practice it more and better, both individually and collectively. What if accountability was so normalized, so everyday, so run-of-the-mill, that it was second nature, that it was our default, that it was something that everyone knew about, and you could easily pass a group of children and youth of any age casually talking about accountability? What if we cherished opportunities to take accountability as precious opportunities to practice liberation, to practice love? What if? What a beautiful vision for the world. It's something that I never considered on my own. You know, I never considered that the whole world could somehow become accountability, but we are visionaries here. We are holding the space of that divine that was in the sacred reading, that space of openness, that space of kindness and forgiveness and innocence, where we are able to stretch past the view of the ego, to push that curtain, that veil out of the way, to get the maya, the energetic out of the way, and see the possibility for a world where people are accountable, and accountability is joyful. So it's actually fun to make a mistake, right? Because then you get to forgive yourself. And it's actually kind of fun when somebody is grumpy to you or somebody is mean to you, because then you get to forgive them. What? Am I crazy? Is this I need a little feedback here, people. You know? Okay, thank you. Because it's this possibility exists for us, and I am so excited about it. Just so excited about it. I want you at home to be excited about it. Stamp your feet and say woo-hoo. You may wonder how to be accountable. And certainly it starts with love. It starts with patience, with self-forgiveness, with doing forgiveness practice every day if you can, starting with yourself, because all forgiveness is self-forgiveness. And if you forgive yourself, you'll be able to forgive others boldly and wisely and wonderfully. I also urge you not to look for the exceptions to this rule. Sometimes you have to hold a hard line with people. And so I'm going to tell you a story about something that I use a lot when I'm looking for how to be accountable. It's a story that's a true story, and it makes sense to me, and I will hopefully help it make sense to you as well as to why it works so well for as a possibility. So this story is from our friend and choir director, Mary Kerrigan, who said this story at a fundraiser for Step Up Ventura that I went to a while back when we could still gather and sing. And Mary is the program director for Step Up Ventura, which is a program that assists children with preschool that are impacted by homelessness. If children get socialization skills and basic play skills and other skills as they're little, then they have a chance of succeeding in kindergarten, and then they have a chance of making it through elementary school and beyond and beyond. And it helps stop the cycle of homelessness at the beginning of someone's lives rather than trying to intervene later. So Mary is the program director of this wonderful program in Ventura, and she was with a group of children, and they were playing. And there was one child there that wasn't particularly well socialized, and he was kind of bossy and perhaps kind of grumpy, and he had the biggest tricycle on the lot. And he was really proud of that tricycle, and he was riding it around and running over people's toes, running over volunteers' toes, running over staff toes, and running over children's toes. Now, Mary knew that she needed to stop this for his own good, just as we sometimes need to stop people for their own good. And so she went up to him, and she put her hand on the tricycle handlebars, and she just held it. And he said, "Let go." And she said, "No, I can't let go. I can't let you run over people's toes anymore." And he said, "I hate you." And she said, "That may be so, but I still can't let you run over people's toes." Now, Mary's pretty feisty, so she won that argument, okay? The kid didn't run over people's toes with a tricycle. But later on, you know, a couple weeks later, he was playing with some kids, and he knocked down this block structure that they were making, and they were upset. And Mary suggested to him, you know, they're going to build it up again. Why don't you try again? Why don't you try again? And so he went, and he went up to the blocks, and instead of knocking it down, he helped build it up. He helped build it up. And then when he was leaving, as he passed Mary, he gave her a high five. "I did it." A life changed through blameless accountability. Now, the metaphor for that with me is, I'll give you three specific points as to why it works so well for me. The first one is when the kid says to her, "I hate you. I hate you." You know, if you haven't done the work on self-love, and somebody tells you that they hate you, they hate your sermon, they hate what you're wearing, you know, they hate your hair, Annette didn't like my outfit last week. So, you know, they tell you that they hate you, and unless you love yourself, that will take hold. And it may cause you to react in a manner that is less than civilized, that is less than kind. So Mary had done the work on self-love. So when the kids said, "I hate you," she just said, "Well, that may be so. Doesn't really have anything to do with me." She didn't say that out loud, but it doesn't really have anything to do with her. It has to do with his mood in the moment. "That may be so, but I still can't let you do this." The other thing is the firmly holding the handlebars in place as an act of kindness. Sometimes, even when we're practicing blameless accountability, we have to hold other people accountable, and that sometimes requires holding their handlebars firmly in place and saying, "I cannot allow you to violate this policy that I have," whether it's a personal policy or whether it's a church policy or a business policy or a family policy. "I just can't let you do that." And it's not only for my good, by the way, it's for the greater good, for the good of the greater whole. "So I just can't let you do that." But then the third thing that I like is that Mary and others hold space in their heart for redemption. She didn't give up on the kid because he was running over people's toes, right? She just kept working with them. And that's the thing about blameless accountability and having civilized conversations with people and trying to help people wake up to a greater reality, trying to help ourselves wake up to a greater reality. It does take time. We're not going to get it on the first shot, right? You're not going to go up to somebody and say, "Hey, I have this great new idea about how the world should be, and I know it's really different than yours." No, it's probably not gonna do anything the first time. You just have to keep building the relationship. We just have to keep building the relationship and building the friendship and seeing what evolves from that, from the beautiful held boundaries through the work on ourselves and from holding that capacity for innocence and redemption. Redemption that is not my redemption, not your redemption, but it is our redemption. It is the greater good. It is the third force, that thing that happens when there's a strong yes and a strong no, and something greater takes hold and creates something beautiful and new. So, you know, my question for all of us this morning is, in doing the self-work, you know, where are places in our lives where we are not holding ourselves accountable? You know, and is that something that you can work on? I recently, during a class, I gave up playing that computer game Candy Crush. It's so addictive. And then I picked it up during the pandemic again because it's an addiction and I can't stop myself. But I stopped and I told some people at the church and I said, "I don't know if I can do it." And my brother Brock over there told me that he would give me like a 12-step chip if I didn't do it for 27 days. And I said, when you talk about chip, could it maybe instead be like a potato chip or a chocolate chip? But just knowing that I'm going to get some kind of a chip, and it is going to be a chocolate chip, by the way, that I'm going to get some kind of a chip at the end of 27 days helps me not pick up Candy Crush again. So there are so many ways that we can practice accountability. And man, if we had people here, I would have us be doing an altar call, and we'd all be standing up and saying our flaws and delighting in each other's flaws and what's wrong with us and all the mistakes that we've made and all of the beautiful, beautiful things that we've done that we're not particularly proud of, but that give us such a great opportunity for, again, redemption, for forgiveness, for grace, for understanding. You see how different that is than the way the world normally thinks? So one more thing. You know, a lot of this started also because I was reading this article by Kelly Wendorf, who is, she's an equine therapist, a horse therapist. And that doesn't mean that, like, she, you know, puts a horse on a couch and says, "Tell me why you hate your mother," you know, your mare, rather. She brings you into a ring with, I've been there, with really big horses, and you have to do stuff with them. And by the way, the horses react to you. She knows what's going on with you. Actually, speaking of boundaries, and I use this with the dog all the time, speaking of accountability, there was a horse that kept butting into our conversation. And she said, "Next time he does that, I want you to put your hands on his chest and say, 'Your place is over there,' and push him back." You know, he only weighs like 20 times more than I do, but I did it and it worked. So I do that. I do that all the time. I do it with people in the church. It doesn't work very well with them, but no, I do it with my dogs, actually. "Your place is over there." Again, Not blaming you, just telling you where your place is, okay? Anyway, Kelly Wendorf wrote this beautiful article about the call-out culture and how perhaps instead of calling people out and displaying all of their flaws and their transgressions on Facebook or other aspects of media or in groups or whatever, you know, doing so with a lot of blame and a lot of shaming and a lot of finger-pointing, what if we could, instead of calling them out, call them in? Call them in. And the way that she describes calling in is this. She says, calling in for me is an internal posture of bringing someone towards what I know is good and right and true. Rather than a sense of sending someone away to their proverbial room, it feels more like an invitation to join something bigger than me or them. It's like sitting on a picnic blanket in a lush open field and patting the ground next to me and saying, hey, you over there, you look really hungry. Come on over here and share this really amazing meal with me. It's that kind of feeling. And it requires that I come from a space of love and presence and deep trust in what I'm inviting them into. So, if you are part of this church, if you are part of this congregation, if you're even listening today, perhaps this is an invitation for all of us that instead of calling people out, instead of being grumpy, getting hit by the grumpy stick and calling people out and blaming them and shaming them, what if instead we could call them in? Imagine that you're sitting on a beautiful picnic blanket called reality, called absolute reality, that is just so filled with love and tenderness and forgiveness that it even understands that the voice of reality is shrill, but God is there too. And what if you could just say, you know what? I got something to share with you. Come sit with me, and we'll figure it out together. That's all I got. Have a good day, and namaste. Let us pray.